From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Verlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. U2 and its frontman Bono have spent decades pursuing causes they're passionate about, and OU professor Alan McPherson's latest book explores the band's activism.
What they had done was really unique and really remarkable, not just in the history of stars becoming activists, but in the history itself of activism.
The band is now involved with dozens of charities, and we'll talk about whether or not this kind of work is sustainable. We'll also examine some of the tangible results of that effort.
He lobbied the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, into increasing the amounts devoted to AIDS prevention. And now 9 million people in Africa are alive because of that money.
How four working-class Irish musicians became international philanthropists. Right after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Rolat. My guest today is Alan McPherson. He's a University of Oklahoma International Studies professor who focuses on the relationship between Latin America and the United States. And we've had him on this program several times to talk about Cuba and Venezuela. But he's also a Gen Xer who grew up in the 1980s, so it's probably not surprising that he's a huge fan of the band U2. The group has spent decades raising millions of dollars and drawing attention to dozens of causes they're passionate about, and that activism is the focus of McPherson's latest book. Alan McPherson, welcome back to Worldviews. You've been on our show before, but it's great to have you here to talk about one of your latest books, The World and U2, One Band's Remaking of Global Activism. Now, this book was recently named one of the top 10 books for 2015 by Globalist magazine, and so you're obviously making a huge hit here with this book, no pun intended. Well, maybe pun intended, huge hit with the U2 book. But this is not your area in general. I mean, you've studied Latin America primarily, a Latin American historian. So can you just start by telling us kind of what took you down this path? I assume you're a U2 fan at a minimum, but what made you study U2's activism?
Yeah, this is a really personal book for me and a personal topic. So I'm really no expert in activism or global affairs, really, outside of Latin America. But this was personal because I've been interested in U2 since I was a teenager, you know, initially because of the music, but also because of the activism. I was an activist myself, sort of a part-time activist. I was sort of the head of an Amnesty International section. And, you know, U2 sort of opened my mind to a lot of these issues. You know, I was reading news and so on, and so I knew about international affairs, but U2 made it seem cool to be an activist and to be interested in human rights. And so I thought, I sort of followed their career and their activism, and I kept seeing in my 20s and 30s and 40s how what they had done was really unique and really remarkable, not just in the history of stars becoming activists, but in the history itself of activism.
Well, I think it's interesting that you raise this issue of how music kind of opened your mind, or their music in particular opened your mind. But I think this is a pretty general comment we can make about music and art, really, is that it kind of opens our minds to a lot of things, but particularly social causes, particular problems around the world. I mean, musicians, artists, others tend to use their craft to bring these things to our attention, do they not? So is there anything particularly new about what U2 was doing? Or, you know, what can you tell us about them specifically that caught your attention?
I mean, the music itself is interesting because it's really not generally message music. I mean, sometimes there's sort of a message buried in there, but U2 are a band that is very focused on emotions. So when they tackle a topic, you know, for instance, the Polish Solidarity Movement in the early 80s, that's the topic of the song New Year's Day.
All is quiet on New Year's Day. The world is wild, it's on the way. I want to be with you now.
Which you might not think so by hearing a song, but they will look at sort of the emotions of this. They'll look at, for instance, a couple that is in love and it's being torn by these politics.
Under a blood red sky, a crowd of
or they'll look at sort of a mining disaster and how this affects an individual specifically. And so they're very much interested, like all artists, in bringing up emotions, but they will tie it to sort of current political issues.
So when you say in the title of your book that this is one band's remaking of global activism, you know, we've seen these kinds of things before, but they're doing something differently, you two. They're remaking this effort to globally engage on particular issues that they find important, that they find to trip some kind of emotional wire on their in their minds. But what specifically are they doing? How are they doing that? Other than just obviously singing about it, you know, writing songs and singing about it, and publicizing particular events or causes in that way. But what beyond that are they doing?
Yeah. Oh, they've moved mountains and mountains of cash, and you could make the case that they've saved millions of lives. And they've put millions of children into schools.
Yeah, so can you give us some specifics of when you say moving mountains of cash? They've raised money, obviously, in many ways, but tell us how they've done that, but also kind of some of the specific outcomes of what they've done with their activism.
Yeah, I mean, this goes far beyond what they were doing in the 80s. In the 80s, they were really raising awareness, and often money, but usually through concerts and that sort of thing. So, for instance, they did a tour with Amnesty International in the mid-80s, and they tripled the membership of Amnesty International just in the United States. So that's something concrete, but it's still just sort of raising awareness among those people. Now, maybe that freed some political prisoners. It's almost impossible to tell if it's because of them. Now, in the 90s, and certainly, especially in the late 90s and the 2000s, they really started branching out into lobbying. And so Bono especially sort of took a big break from the band with their permission and said, listen, I'm going to become almost a full-time activist, but really an activist who lobbies and tries to get, you know, direct diplomacy with policymakers to get them to change laws, or at least to sort of change the dollar amounts within laws. So he went all over the world. Of course, he didn't do any of this by himself. He was always in association with Drop the Debt or the Jubilee Movement, you know, major organizations. But he was the public face. And he learned a lot about these things. He learned about the sort of how you get laws passed, how you get things moving, who you talk to, for instance, in the U.S. Congress, which committee chair are you going to talk to. He would show up with the facts. He would lobby them like any other lobbyist would. He just had more access to them because he was famous and they wanted him, you know, they wanted to impress their staffers. They wanted to impress their sons and daughters.
Who doesn't want to hang out with Bono, right?
That's right. You know, they want to come back, you know, on the weekends to Florida and say, look who I hung out with during the week. And so he would get their attention, and he got things moving. I mean, with these movements, for instance, I'll give you some specific achievements. In terms of reducing the debt of highly indebted poor countries, they probably reduced those debts by about $90 billion. And that's a lot of money. And that money now, we now know by, you know, 2016, that money now has gone to 51 more children in Africa attending schools. He lobbied the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, into increasing the amounts devoted to AIDS prevention. And now 9 million people in Africa are alive because of that money. Now, of course, it might have happened without him, but it also might not have happened without him. You know, there's all sorts of statistics, you know, millions and millions of nets to prevent malaria, you know, bed nets, all sorts of things like that. And so by now, it's pretty clear that there are some concrete achievements due to the lobbying of Bono and to a certain extent of U2. They have sort of smaller charities. I mean, they've got – the band altogether probably has 40 causes and charities that they're into.
So obviously, Bono and his bandmates are leveraging their power and celebrity to get things done. They're not only raising awareness, but they're actually moving, like you said, mountains of cash and influencing decision makers. And it's had tremendous results. But what can you tell us about what's influenced them? How did they come to this? I mean, they have a relatively poor background, from what I understand, where they come from. Have they just always been this way? Have they just been waiting till the moment till they could use that power and celebrity that they have? You know, what actually motivates them? Because you then have to ask the question, why don't others do this? You know, we're seeing it more and more. We're seeing several celebrities go out there and, as you refer to in your book, kind of engage in superstar lobbying. But why them? You know, why a few others, but not all of them?
Yeah, we've got to go back to the 1970s, to their sort of birth as a band in 1976, to understand why they became such large activists. You know, they combine a series of things that make them who they are. One is that they're from Ireland. And this is really sort of chapter one in the book, is sort of setting the scene, you know. And they don't really think they're ever going to leave Ireland. They're sort of middle class, lower middle class. They're not very, very poor, but it's a poor society. It's a very traditional Catholic society. And so, you know, everybody almost is working class, and they end up spending their nights in the pub, drinking themselves to death. And these four boys do not want this at all, you know. They're not interested in partying. They're interested in working hard, making music, and leaving Ireland. But they're influenced by poverty. They're influenced by the violence that they see in the youth among them. They're influenced by the situation in Northern Ireland, which is, you know, granted several hundred miles from Dublin, where they come from, but there are some violent incidents in Dublin that really mark them. And of course, it's in the news all the time, you know. They're influenced by the religious strife between Protestants and Catholics. The band itself is mixed. Some are fully Catholic, some are half and half, some are Protestant, some are non-religious. And so they're early on sort of, they want a more sort of open, diverse and sort of tolerant world. They happen to all meet at a high school that encourages all of these things. It's sort of the first public coeducational high school in Ireland. And they get there in the first couple of years that it's open. And so they have these teachers who encourage them to do music, to do poetry. They don't indoctrinate them into sort of Catholic dogma. And so they're free to think. And so the school is very important to them.
But religion does come across in their music, does it not? I mean, can you tell us a little bit about that? And also the conflict in Ireland, and particularly in Northern Ireland. You know, I mean, the songs Sunday Bloody Sunday, for example, is one that seems to reflect these things that they're experiencing.
I can't believe.
Right. And in their first sort of two, three records, you can see these two very prominent themes, which is Irish politics and religion. They're very religious. I mean, at some point after their first album, they actually are almost convinced to leave music altogether because they don't like the sin that's associated with rock and roll. And they've sort of joined a movement that tells them you shouldn't be rock stars, it's evil. And they finally say, we can do more good by being rock stars than by not being rock stars. And the bassist, who's not religious at all, is really pushing for that interpretation. And so that wins out. But they come close. I mean, they take seriously the morality of in their lives. Ireland is always important to them, but they're also not aligned on one side or the other. They're mostly for the sort of soft middle stance of let's all talk this through. Let's not have violence. Let's have peace. But they're not, you know, they're not taking a stance on a particular situation, which earns them a lot of criticism from the Irish, who are very much divided, especially in the late 70s, early 80s, on you've got to be on one side or the other.
I'm talking with Alan McPherson about his latest book, which focuses on U2's nearly four-decade career as both rock musicians and international activists. You can find excerpts of the book on our website, kgou.org. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more.
Is it getting better? Or do you feel the same? Will it make it easier on you now? You got someone
to blame. You're saying one love, one life, when it's one need in the night. One love, we get to share it. Leisure, baby.
I'm Suzette Grolot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grolot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. This half hour, I'm talking with my colleague, Alan McPherson. He's just written a book called The World and You Too, One Band's Remaking of Global Activism. When we left off, he was talking about the band's upbringing in Dublin during the height of the conflict with Northern Ireland.
Well, you have to ask the question, how sustainable is this type of activism? There are some critics out there who say that, you know, superstars and celebrities don't belong in this kind of, you know, political, economic sphere. Because we can list a number of other celebrities that do these sorts of things and raise awareness and raise cash and try to influence, you know, policymakers and others, decision makers, leaders, and the community. But that, you know, some might say these aren't elected officials. These aren't people that were put into their position because, you know, of what they know. It's more just because they're celebrities, because they're rock stars, you know. And so why are we listening to rock stars tell us what we should do with our money or with our policies? And then the question of sustainability, you know, how can you tell us anything about how the work that you two has done that you've mentioned, you outlined earlier, that, you know, how, what's the longevity of this sort of thing? Or as soon as Bono and you two are gone from the scene, you know, and this is off the front pages, you know, how likely is it to that these solutions that they found will continue?
Well, those are two great questions. I mean, one is, you know, should celebrities be doing this sort of high-level activism, or should they just be sort of spokespersons for certain organizations, which they've always done? I think that there's an aspect that's disturbing about this, which is that they're doing politicians' job because politicians are not doing their job anymore. They've sort of given up on a lot of development issues. They are increasingly cheap with their development and their foreign aid budgets. I mean, the One campaign was started based on the song One, but the point of this was to get Western governments to devote 1% of their budget to foreign aid. Right now, it's about a third of 1% that they devote, and the United States does even less than that, right? Maybe the Scandinavian countries get close to 1%. And so what Bono, and not just other celebrities, but other very wealthy people who aren't elected, such as Bill Gates, right? Billionaires who aren't really celebrities, they're just simply billionaires. They're filling the gap that exists. And it is disturbing that they're not elected, but our elected officials aren't doing this. And so you need people from the outside to sort of push them to do the right thing. I mean, eventually it does have to go through elected officials. Some of it does, right? Of course, Bill Gates can have his own foundation and so on. But you need people to lobby them. So it's sort of an evil in a sense, but it's a necessary evil. Now, whether it's sustainable or not is an interesting question too. A lot of celebrity activism by its very nature is not sustainable because people follow celebrities and then they start disliking celebrities, so they'll start, you know, they'll pay less attention to their cause also. What Bono has done, especially Bono, was to create these organizations. For instance, One has started as the One campaign in the 2000s. Now it's simply called One. It is not a campaign anymore. It is a permanent lobbying organization established in Washington, D.C. It has professional lobbyists who are paid a lot of money. It's got people from the establishment, like Condoleezza Rice, I think, was on its board of directors, right? People from the right, people from the left who believe in the mission of One. And they will take on all sorts of commitments. And so it's a permanent lobbying organization for the world's poor in the United States, and it acts globally. And so once Bono is gone, it can continue. It'll have less star power, clearly. But as a mechanism that is funded and it acts and it's got sort of a professional staff, it could go on for decades.
Well, tell us a little bit as we conclude our discussion today, Alan, about kind of the future of this kind of activism as we have been talking about U2 and its and the sustainability of its work and the institutionalization, basically, of its movement. But what's in the future for not only U2 but other rock stars or other celebrities. You think about groups like Coldplay, for example, are very active in the fair trade movement. I mean, are there others that we should be looking for? Are there other movements that you can you know, pinpoint as kind of the future? And I ask this question specifically because you mentioned the filling of the gap, that these types of individuals, these types of groups, people like Bill and Melinda Gates, for example, others that, you know, are wealthy, well-known, high profile, that this is kind of the future of not only American politics, but international politics, and that, you know, we have governments that cannot provide all of these kinds of services or won't provide these kinds of services, and therefore we need these kinds of activists well into the future.
Right. I mean, it's hard to predict the future, but certainly there are, you know, the world we live in now is a world of superstars and of super rich. And so those things are only getting worse year by year. You know, the positive side of that is that some of these super rich superstars are good people and they want to give most of their money away. Mark Zuckerberg and his wife are one example, for instance, right, who said they're going to do this for the rest of their lives. And so I can't think of sort of a young music superstar that is doing, you know, to the extent of what Bono is doing or what YouTube, but there's going to be some also who are going to be very wealthy. And of course, music has become a lot less wealthy because of the internet. That's sort of an ironic, but I mean, movie stars can do this and have done this. And so you're going to have increasingly super rich, super billionaires who are going to be able to sort of take up this mantle when YouTube stops doing it. But I think YouTube's going to do this for as long as they live.
It sounds like something that's really just ingrained in who they are and where they come from. So, Alan, what an interesting book. Thank you so much for bringing this to our attention, for speaking with us today about wonderful music and wonderful people. Thanks.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to my conversation with University of Oklahoma International Studies professor Alan McPherson. He's just written a book called The World in You Too, One Band's Remaking of Global Activism. And you can find excerpts on our website, kgou.org. While you're there, you'll find all of our past episodes, and you can find a link to subscribe to our show as a podcast. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between KGOU and OU's College of International Studies. Sam Dupre and Brian Hardzinski produce the show, and Brian also runs our Twitter feed and the show's webpage. I'm Suzette Grolot.